Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. For many of us, adolescence was marked by the longing to fit in, to be liked and accepted by our peers. The word popular is often used to refer to the teen experience, but today's guest says the desire to be a part of the group actually begins when we're toddlers and continues through our lives, that it is hardwired into who we are as humans. Popularity can affect our success at work and in relationships, and being unpopular can actually have a negative effect on health and mortality. And yes, social media has upped the stakes. Mitch Prinstein's new book is called Popular: The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World, and he is also professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he joins us for the hour with more on the power of popularity. Great to have you back with us on Radio Times, Mitch.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
And before we get going, I'd like to give our number out, 888-477-9499, if you'd like to join the conversation, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, or an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Mitch, when we talk about popularity, it's easy to conjure up the movie version of the word, the jock and the cheerleader, prom king, prom queen. But let's begin by defining what you mean by the word popular.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It turns out there are two different kinds of popularity, and most of us tend to be thinking about only one of them when we talk about the subject. When we're really little, those kids who are the most popular are the ones who are most likable. They are leaders. They are kind. They help others. They care about others' feelings. And they tend to have benefits that last them their entire lives. But as you say, once we get into high school, popularity is more that cool kid who's visible and influential and powerful. And turns out that does not predict good long-term outcomes.
And so according to research, as you know, teens and adults, many of us seek the wrong type of popularity or the status type of popularity?
Yeah, that second form of popularity referred to as status has really dominated a lot. Even if you just look at the last 10 or 20 years or so, we've gone from a world that really cared about likability to one that's prioritizing status more and more. And this is kind of scary, not just for us, but also for our kids.
Is there an immediate sense of gratification with status, Mitch?
Yeah, so it seems that it's new research has shown that once you turn, once you start going through puberty, your brain actually begins to change. And one of the first changes that happens is that you have two new kinds of receptors in your brain for oxytocin and for dopamine. And when you put those two things together, it makes us really crave attention from our peers and any kind of rewards that are social in nature. If it feels like a high, it's not an accident. Those are the same kinds of things that make us feel a high from recreational drugs, and it can be addictive.
All right. Well, we're going to tackle adolescence in a minute, but I'd like to go back once again, kind of to the beginning of your book, actually. We're talking about a sense of popularity that begins when humans are very young. And you actually open your book by telling the story of Doug and Jill and David and the great cootie epidemic of old Bethpage. Wait, could you tell that story for us?
Sure. Yeah, we were, it was a real story in my life. In elementary school, and I remember I was probably around seven or so, and I remember just then, you know, being really interested in popularity. There were those kids who suddenly had the magic cure for cooties, it seemed, the cooties shot, right? And everyone came running over to Doug and Jill, and they kind of set the rules for the game. We all gravitated towards these other seven-year-olds, but when another kid tried to do the same thing and announced that they had, you know, the cure, no one went running up to David at all. And it was really fascinating, even back then, to realize that the social hierarchy had already been set. And that hierarchy would remain pretty consistent for well over a decade.
So the patterns tend to stay in place.
Yeah, there's research that says that if you are really, really well-liked as a young kid, even at the age of three, it's likely that that will still be the case for you, not only through elementary, middle, and high school, but well into adulthood. And similarly, the converse, if you're really disliked that tends to be a reputation that you keep even as you transfer from school to school.
Yeah. And then, you know, heading again toward adolescence, it seems as if that switch is turned on and even amplified at age 10 or 11 when kids become even more aware of liked or of having status. Is that kind of about the ballpark, middle school, where it starts to really become evident? And again, this is biology?
Yeah, some say that it's really an evolutionary kind of push to get us to be interested in autonomy. You know, so we are biologically programmed to think that our parents have become really lame when we're around 12 years old, because it's the body's way of getting us ready to figure out how to sustain ourselves. And that's the reason why all of a sudden everything seems to be about popularity at around 11, 12 years old. Of course, the problem is that that's also the same time that our identity is being developed in a more stable way. So how popular you were got tied all up in how you think about yourself in a way that I hope the book helps people break, but otherwise could really continue to affect you for a really long time.
Yeah. Before we, again, dive more into the adolescent and then into the young adult and older adult piece of it, you kind of brought up, you know, the fact that we're innately sensitive to popularity. And let's take a look at human history. This stretches back thousands of years to natural selection, does it not? Could you tell us about that?
So, sure. About 60,000 years ago, we started to gain an advantage over the other human-like species on the planet, research says. And it turns out that the thing that made us survive and not the others is that we became a social species. There was something about our voice box and our brains that allowed us to communicate, and with some communication came the opportunity to work together. And now it's really interesting. Our brains, at the moment that it seems like we may get rejected from the herd, marginalized and ostracized, there are a couple of things that happen that no one ever realized was happening before. The first thing is in our brains. Our brain sends the most powerful signal it has to tell us to get back in the herd. So whether we think that we care about popularity or not, our brains actually respond in an emergency way the minute that we think that we've been ostracized. And the second thing that happens is that signal in the brain, it actually turns on dormant DNA in our bodies. And that dormant DNA prepares us for injury. Because, of course, back then, if you were kicked out of the herd, you might get attacked by a woolly mammoth at any minute. So our body responds to that with a system-wide inflammation response. Interestingly, today, most of the diseases people suffer from are based on that inflammation response.
Yeah. So so if we're, say, criticized and judged by somebody who means something to us then, so clarify a little bit more. What happens in our bodies with our genes? The genes react and then we come up with an immune system response? That's what you're saying? What is actually going on? Is it fight or flight or what's happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the fight or flight response does begin, but what happens downstream from that is that a few of our genes turn on and a few of them turn off. The genes that turn on produce this inflammation response to get us ready for attack. So if it was the case that being defriended on Facebook made us at physical threat, this would all be very helpful. But it doesn't anymore. What's happening is that our bodies think that we're about to get our arm eaten off by a woolly mammoth, so it prepares us for bacterial infection, and that's why we have the inflammation response. The genes that get turned off are our viral immunity, and the reason why is because if you are kicked out of the herd, well, there's no one to catch a virus from anymore. So to conserve energy, our body shuts off that viral immunity, and we become more susceptible to colds.
Hmm. Well, so Mitch Prinstein, you are a professor of neuroscience. What can we do if we're hardwired to react in this way? What can we do to counteract this?
Well, it's a great question, and I hope that people get help from the book and realize how much power we have over this entire system, and not just our health, but also how we feel about our popularity. because all of this is mediated by the extent to which we think about how we think about rejection. So imagine, for instance, that you're out waiting for a meeting and someone shows up late. You know, we've all had that experience where either we can decide that we're being rejected and blown off and stood up and it might start to really feel bad. That's going to trigger all of these physical responses. But sometimes we're a little too quick to judgment on that. And it might be for any other number of reasons that somebody has come late. Well, it turns out that how we think about what's happening to us completely changes the effects of our social experiences on our bodies and on our happiness.
So you recommend perhaps taking a step back and really taking a second look at a situation to prevent a negative immune system response?
That's exactly right. And we also want to see how much we're still reacting to the world around us like we're still that 14-year-old, you know, expecting things to happen the way that they did when we were in high school, and how much we're taking in new information. And the reason why that's important is because there's actually research that says that if you show somebody a video, if you show, a number of people the same video, and some used to be popular and some were not, they will literally see different things in that video. Hmm. So we are looking at the world and selecting out, kind of like a filter based on our teenage popularity, we're either selecting out those things that fit what we used to go through or that don't fit. And we can override that just by being aware of the process.
You know, it's been decades since I was a teenager. We'll leave it at that.
Me too.
But, you know, many of us think, oh, yeah, it was a long time ago. That doesn't affect me. But you say that someplace inside, it affects most of us. It's still there.
It not only affects us. Statistics and from research studies have shown that it changes literally what we see with our eyes. It changes the way we interpret those things that we see, and it changes the decisions that we make and how to respond to things in such fast ways that we're not even aware that it's happening unless we're looking at it in a research study. That's why it's so important for us to think about our old popularity and just really confront, is this something that's still playing out or not? You know, there's some research that says that who we were when we were about 15 is predicting our lives today more than who we are right now.
Oh, you know, that was such an awkward age. That's a tough thought.
Exactly.
It really was. Well, what about we only have about 30 seconds till the break, but what about the kids who seem to float through middle school and high school? Do they have a leg up here?
Well, if they were likable, then that's a great form of popularity. And you know something they do? I can tell you about it in more detail, but the short version is that we give people the benefit of the doubt if we like them in all different contexts, in our relationships, at work. They do much better in the workplace and are also happier, and they turn out to be even better parents.
All right, more on
they
this.
They do get a leg up.
Okay, more on this conversation in just a moment. Here on Radio Times, Mitch Prinstein is author of Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. And if you'd like to join the conversation, lines are open, 888-477-9499. Does your sense of being a teen still stick with you years or decades later? Let us know. Radio Times continues in a moment. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about popularity this hour with Mitch Prinstein, who's professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is also author of Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. And we were talking about how your high school experiences and middle school experiences can stick with you pretty much, perhaps subconsciously, through your entire life, for better or for worse. And right now we've got a clip that we're going to play that might just illustrate that. Let's go.
Kelsey, it's Liz Lemon.
Oh my God.
Yeah, surprising. But cocoon, and then flap, 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 butterfly.
Wow, I did not think you'd come.
Well, I almost didn't. I was in Manhattan working in the fast lane.
You made life a living hell for everyone here. You would have to come to the reunion and make us go through it all again.
What?
You know, I tried to befriend you just so you'd leave me alone.
What are you talking about? I was a nerd.
You were a bully.
We were all afraid of you.
We called you the White Haven Witch.
Lemon!
Oh, Aaron, no. don't sink to her level.
This is a beauty mark. But you thought it was funny to say that God pooped on me.
Well, I didn't think anybody was listening to me. I was a nobody. You were homecoming queen. I have had years of therapy.
Kels, your facial tick.
Oh!
You brought it back. You happy?
That is from 30 Rock, in which Liz Lemon, played by Tina Fey, goes to her high school reunion to show the popular kids how she's transformed from a nerd to a successful woman. But Mitch Princeton, even the cool kids can feel like losers at times, it seems. Perspective is everything, right? Do we have Mitch Princeton with us? Okay, we are going to work to get him back. Mitch Princeton again. Oh, hello, Mitch. I don't know if you heard the clip that we played from 30 Rock. The character played by Tina Fey, Liz Lemon, goes to her high school reunion. And she apparently was one of the terrible popular kids, and she never realized it. So, you know, it's important to remember that, even the cool kids can feel like losers. It's all about perspective. Okay. So, Mitch, are you with us? All right. Not so sure that Mitch Princeton is still with us at this moment. I'm not hearing him. I know we're having a little bit of difficulty with the phone connection. But again, what we're talking about this hour is the fact that our adolescence and our popularity or lack thereof can apparently carry through our lives. There are two different types of popularity that Mitch has identified in his book called Popular, The Power of Likeability. One is likeability. And Mitch, if you're there, jump in at any time, because you can define this much better than I can.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. And again, as a refresher, as we're going into the second segment here, there are two different types of popularity. One is definitely much more desirable, and that is likability as opposed to status. And if you could just give us a quick refresher on those definitions.
Sure. So likability is the kind of popularity that's really starts so early, and it's based on people enjoying spending time with us because we make them feel valued. We make them feel important. We're kind to them, and we care about making them feel a part of the group. But, of course, that's not the kind of popularity we remember. We think about those cool bullies who are very visible and influential. And there's been a lot of interesting research to say that the kids who had that kind of popularity in high school, they actually grow up to experience a number of difficulties.
Such as what?
Well, the kids who were the most popular in terms of the highest status, they exhibit relationship problems. They're at higher risk for addictions, depression, and anxiety. It seems like they've peaked too soon, and they've started to become so focused on status that it interferes with their relationships as adults.
So, Mitch, I was, along those lines, was reading an interesting article in The Cut about alpha girls and alpha boys. The alpha girl tends to emerge in high school. She, quite often is beautiful, but she's also somewhat rebellious. Maybe she skips class or she parties. She's kind of, thrilling to be around. I guess think Rizzo in Greece. how does this girl come to develop through middle school and high school? And again, why is she so attractive to people who might not be alphas?
Well, it's not just us humans. It's a lot of different species that look to whoever is in the most powerful position in the herd as being the ones that we're programmed to really pay attention to and try and emulate. It's amazing how much we're influenced by the high status folks, even when we don't like them very much. And one of the main reasons why is that in order to have that kind of high status, you have to be kind of aggressive. And sometimes we find ourselves gravitating towards those who are aggressive because we don't want to end up being their victims. Hmm.
So, and you also say an alpha boy can have status and be likable as well. So you're combining the two types of popularity, but not so much for the girls?
Well, it's so much harder for girls. It's really unfair in a way. The way that girls are expected in society, kind of that stereotype, to be so good at their social relationships. So when a girl gets that high level of status, it seems that a lot of the other girls really turn on them and simultaneously hate and envy those alpha girls. It's not only a problem in high school, but it really affects kind of our society and the pressures that girls face in adulthood as well, mm-hmm. As they achieve high status positions as grownups.
And Mitch, since this sets the template for what many of us are going to experience throughout our lives, you know, how would you counsel parents to help boys and girls navigate this so that I'm guessing they look for likability as popularity as opposed to status?
Exactly. You know, in a world where we have teen magazines that are explaining to kids how to become kind of, quote, social media famous, and where cosmetics companies are selling makeup to girls to look good in their selfies, it's really important. Parents may be the only ones that are giving the message that status does not matter. It's not the kind of popularity that leads to long-term outcomes. Parents hopefully will explain the difference between status and likability to their kids and help their kids claim likability as the value that's worth striving for, not just the number of their Instagram followers.
Let me reintroduce you. Mitch Prinstein is author of Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. And we're talking about the power of popularity, not only as an adolescent, but as, you know, very young child and throughout life. And right now, Mitch, what I'd like to do is bring in back into the conversation social media and how this all folds into kids who are coming up and setting the template. You know, at the time I came up, there was no social media. And I've often thought watching my own kids grow up and navigate social media, you know, thank goodness I didn't have to do this during adolescence. I would have been terrible at it. You know, as much fun as Twitter and Facebook and Instagram can be, there's also a lot of focus on likes and followers. So how does social media amplify the popularity question?
Well, it's a great question. And it is a really scary time to be raising kids when it comes to this issue, because we know that adolescents are biologically primed to want to get that kind of status. So that's normal. But we've now made it a little bit too easy for kids to focus so intensively on the number of their followers that they will do almost anything just to get more likes, whether that's hurting another peer, posting things that might be inappropriate. Social media has made it very easy for kids to become quite addicted to the kind of popularity that will ultimately serve them poorly.
And again, you know, at this age, you know, kids don't tell their parents everything or much of anything at times. So if you are a family member, you're trying to guide a young person through this this landscape, what are some of the red flags that you can look for to help them navigate popularity on social media?
Well, I think one of the things that's important for parents to model themselves, but also to talk directly with their kids about, is how they're using social media. Social media can be used to generate likability or status. I think if you're posting things just to get a lot of likes, and likes is a funny word because it's not really about likability, is it? If you're taking things down simply because they didn't get enough comments as quickly as you would hope, that's a measure of status seeking. And that's probably not the best way to use social media. But, you know, for a lot of kids, social media is a place where they can develop real friendships. They can feel connected to people with similar values, especially if they don't have those folks in their school environment. It's a place for coping, for celebrating, for sharing and really learning about one another. That's all great. That's great ways of developing likability. I think it's really important for parents to sit with their kids and really look at what kinds of activities they're engaging in and ask themselves, is this being done to promote your status or to really cultivate relationships?
And we've got some comments coming in now to Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we've got a text from a listener, and this is of the moment, Mitch. How about elective politics? Where does that fit into the evolutionary scale? One might think that people would avoid courting rejection.
Well, you know, I wrote this book and finished it before November. And now if we look at the political landscape, I think it really clearly reflects that our society has moved so much more towards status than likability in a way that studies that have looked at this over decades have shown a more dramatic shift in our society's values in just 10 or 20 years than we've seen in the hundreds of years before it. I mean, look at our president. This guy, no matter if you're Republican or Democrat, I think we can all agree, he loves to search for his popularity, doesn't he? He's really addicted to measures of his own status.
And also, too, you know, some of the discourse online, you know, even from friends, people who are true friends, you know, I know I find myself wanting to back away from it because it's so passionate. How can that play into and how can that kind of move us away from likability as opposed to status? How should we navigate that?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's happened with our political discussions is we've started to get a bit aggressive with each other online. You know, the conversation is so heated and intense that some of the people whom we have as friends on Facebook, for instance, are now our political adversaries. And, you know, that aggressive behavior is going to lead to being disliked very quickly. It's also a really difficult forum to have the kind of sensitive and charged discussions that we're all so aching to have right now. So it is a little bit hard to have a real debate on social media with the kind of complexity that today's times call for.
Mm. Mitch Finstein, according to research, popularity can actually determine how long we live. You discuss a remarkable study out of Brigham Young University that found, you know, being unpopular is a great predictor of mortality, more than obesity or binge drinking, that sort of thing, really?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? For all the time and money that we spend on things like dieting and the exercise industry, it turns out that our popularity, the effects of being unpopular on our likelihood of mortality, the only thing as strong is the effects of smoking. Hmm. It's that powerful a factor. And it's not just because it influences how we feel. It has this biological effect on our ability to cope with stress and on the decay of our body.
And it can actually affect our immune system negatively.
That's right. And it affects our DNA. It changes our immunity. And it shortens our lifespan if we're unpopular.
Can that sort of thing, that sort of effect on your DNA, on genetics, can that be passed along to your children?
There's now research looking at that. So we'll have to see over time. There's some discussion that it might have an effect on grandchildren, believe it or not, because the seeds for those grandchildren are in your body. If you are pregnant while experiencing this, then the seeds for your grandchildren are in your body while you're experiencing this. So some epigenetic phenomenon actually skip a generation for that reason.
All right, we've got a tweet from Jay who says, I've been popular and I've been a loser. Either way, I'm still plagued by the same doubts. Same with fitness, sign of being human. So I'm not sure that Jay would call himself an introvert, Mitch Finstein, but you know, some people are naturally introverts. Are these folks at a disadvantage here?
Not at all. Extroverts and introverts are just as likely to be very well liked. But what Jay might be talking about is a phenomenon I talk a little bit about in the book called Rejection Sensitivity. The tendency for some people to just anticipate that they're about to be rejected and to feel that that affects them in serious ways. It's something that everyone experiences now and again, but some people feel particularly concerned about that more than others.
Is that learned or is that hardwired?
Well, there's research that says that it could be learned. Those who are rejection sensitive or those who may have had some difficulties with being bullied or with feeling on the outside of their group when they were really young.
We've got a tweet from Allie who asks, what about kids who intentionally isolate?
Yeah, that's a great question. We can divide kids based on their likability. I should say also adults based on their likability into five groups. One of those groups is an average group, but the other four are the kids who are accepted, rejected, neglected, or controversial. Those controversial kids are equally liked and disliked, but they're very, very visible. But the neglected kids are those who are kind of invisible, and in some cases, they're just not that interested in interacting with other peers. It turns out that they do okay. It's the neglected kids who feel really anxious and wish that they could be more noticed they turn out to have some more difficulties down the road.
Is that, in that case, again, does a family member, the concerned parent, maybe step in and try to encourage likability and to teach likability? Because likability, does that get you someplace even in the cauldron that is high school if you come in as an adult neglected kid?
It does. I mean, likability is worth pursuing all the time, not to become submissive or not to put others' needs ahead of yours. But let's face it, people who are likable do better in so many different ways, not just because people give them the benefit of the doubt, but they get extra experiences to learn. In the book, I talk about ways that parents can enhance their kids' likability that are reasonable, that are not putting too much pressure on the situation. Because research says that parents can have a very big effect on how likable their kids turn out to be.
All right, tweet from Carrie. This is my life. Cheerleader in high school, serious depression, no close friends. Now, mom was obsessed with status. So, okay, we kind of go perhaps back to parents and how they might influence their children and how their children fare with popularity.
You know, a lot of people don't understand the two different kinds of popularity, which makes sense because it's something that's only recently been appreciated by scientists. So parents make the perfectly understandable mistake of encouraging their child to have as much attention as possible at school or celebrate when they're voted for prom court or kind of speak with other parents about how they're the envy of all the other kids. And that makes sense. But what we don't realize sometimes is when we say that, we're kind of communicating to our kids that they should also care about these measures of status. Sometimes a better idea would be for parents to really celebrate out loud how much their kids are caring about somebody else, making them feel included when no one else did.
All right, Mitch, hold that thought. We're up against a break.
Okay,
and
sure.
Mitch Prinstein is author of Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment or two here on Radio Time. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan, Marty Moscowain has the day off today. Our guest is Mitch Prinstein. He is author of Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. And going into the break, we were talking about a tweet from Carrie, who's a former cheerleader in high school and is now, she says she's dealing with some serious depression. Her mom was obsessed with status. And Mitch, you were talking about, you know, parents and their role in perhaps unknowingly shaping their children as far as likability or the race to obtain status is concerned.
That's right. And I think that given the times that we live in, it's become very easy for us all to be a little too focused on status and to accidentally communicate that message to our kids. But there was an interesting study that was done looking at the diaries of young children. And they looked at diaries from about 100 years ago and from now. And the truth is, our society has led to kids today in their diaries talking about wanting to be the most attractive, the most well-known, to get all the attention. That's not what we used to say. That's not what we all used to care about as a society. The diaries from decades earlier talked about wanting to make a difference and contribute to one's community and help others to feel good. I think it's up to parents to remind kids that those are still virtues that are worth considering and encouraging in our kids.
Now, there have been, on another note here, this has fascinated us, popularity in our culture. How many movies have been made about this issue? Let's get to a clip from the movie The Breakfast Club. And in it, Claire, played by Molly Ringwald, describes her life as a popular high school student, while Brian, played by Anthony Michael Hall, is a nerd who takes offense.
I hate it. I hate having to go along with everything my friends say.
Well, then why do you do it?
I don't know. I don't... You don't understand. You don't... You're not friends with the same kind of people that Annie and I are friends with. You know, you just don't understand the pressure that they can put on you.
I don't understand what? You think I don't understand pressure, Claire? You.
And we had to bleep a couple of words out there. But Mitch Prinstein, you say the most potent predictors of why adolescents engage in all kinds of health risk behaviors. And you can see there's a lot of emotion there in that clip. You know, it's only a movie, but still, you know, they perceive their close friends are doing the same thing, whether it's substance abuse, sexual behavior, even recently self-cutting. Again, what can parents, guardians do to counteract this and to help out with the emotion that the kids feel during that age?
That's a great question. And it's true. It is the biggest predictor for kids engaging in these risky behaviors is the extent to which they think their closest friends or the most popular kids in school are engaging in these behaviors. And the reason why is because kids believe that they will feel they will become a better person. Not just that they think others will like them, but they truly feel that they will become a better person in their own eyes if they are more like the popular kids. There's a biological reason why they're feeling that way. Their identity is tied in with all of the cues and all of the brain's reinforcements towards what the popular kids are doing. So that's where parents can come in and remind them of the ways in which their identity can be based on things that are not just what other peers think of them.
All right, we've got an email from Lori who says, curious about the impact of likability within the family. If you were the one always on the outside, such as in a big family, with the ability to form alliances, what long-term effects could that have? And I can say firsthand, Lori says, it never goes away, at least in my head. So it's not just high school, Mitch.
It's true. I mean, it's amazing how much these kinds of things stick with us and become a template that we see the rest of the world through. The reason why that's important and our likability even within our family is that research shows that when you're well-liked, you're actually given new experiences. You're invited to another party or you're part of an important conversation. And each of those experiences actually become a moment for learning. You get new skills, you get new insight, you get new information. And of course, that only makes you more likely to do well the next time. Whereas those kids who are not well-liked in whatever context, they miss out on those experiences, which means that they're not learning as quickly. They're not getting access to resources. That makes them more disliked in the next day and so on, in a real downward cycle.
Where does learning to interpret social cues fit into the efforts to develop likability?
This is a really important way that parents can play a role with their kids very young. So parents who have kids who are really likable are not all the parents who themselves were likable. It's actually the parents who care about their kids doing well with their peers that have the kids who do the best. And one of the reasons why that makes a difference is because these are the parents who are coaching their kids, talking with their kids after each interaction with peers, processing it with them, asking them, what did you notice? What are other ways you could have handled that situation? And so on. That stuff makes a big difference.
Yeah. And for those of us who are no longer living with our parents, I'm assuming this is the sort of thing we can take to internalize and move forward, because as you say, a lot of this stuff stays with us through our lives.
Yeah, it's really interesting how much we like to say that our high school experiences are completely in the past, and we've gone beyond that. But I think we all know that there are those moments, they may not be our best moments, that they kind of creep back up a little bit. And in the book, I hope that people will see how to notice when those automatic reactions are happening and how to stop them. Because once you're aware of the process, it's actually pretty easy to override those patterns with new experiences.
Mitch Prinstein, I have to ask this question, personal question. Were you a popular kid in high school? Were thereabouts?
I did not have high status. No, I was short statured. I had bifocals. There was no hope for me whatsoever. So I was not one of the cool kids.
But I had thick glasses, you know,
too. Yeah. You know, I think that I was likable. You know, I don't know that I was the most likable, but I think that being likable ended up becoming important in ways that being cool and having high status did not. And it was fascinating for me personally, the more that I did research on this topic and read of others' work, to see that that's exactly what the science is showing as well. So in some ways, I feel like I was lucky to be able to have those experiences being at least somewhat likable. And it helped me to not worry or have hang-ups about not having been cool.
Well, tell us about the people in your life and how they might have helped you along with that, or not, if that weren't the case.
Yeah, I think, you know, being someone with a good sense of humor and being excited to talk with other people and help them to feel good about themselves really did open up doors in the way that the research says that it does. I was invited into study groups, and teachers took time to explain things to me in ways that undoubtedly changed my academic progress. I was invited to talk about things when I was stressed or hear about other people's stress in a way that helped me develop emotionally. All of the ways in which likability can really change our opportunities are things that I feel really lucky to have benefited from.
We are chatting with Mitch Prinstein, who is the author of Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World, taking calls at 888-477-9499. Email, send it to radiotimes at whyy.org or a tweet at whyyradiotimes. We've got an email from Gina who says, given your comments about the neurological benefits we derive from social affirmation, do you think this new college identities concept could serve as an important function in today's status-obsessed world? And I'm not familiar with new college identities concept. Are you? And what do you think?
I haven't heard of that, but I do know that some universities are trying to help everyone find their niche within a university setting, and I wonder if that's related. If so, I think that it's great for people to find a way of not having to fit in to the overall kind of group, but a small group of people that they can feel very liked within. I think that is more important than ultimately having tens of thousands of followers, anonymous followers, or fitting some norm.
Back to likability for a moment, Mitch. Can we become maybe even a little obsessed with being likable? We can try too hard, and this can backfire. It doesn't seem natural, doesn't seem genuine. How do you find the right balance?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what's really important is that we're being sincere, that our desire to be likable is leading us to just express how we actually care for people rather than attempting to make it seem like we care when we don't. Everyone will spot a faker. And more importantly, everyone will also spot a status seeker, and that tends to make us very disliked.
We've got a tweet from Paul who asks, oh, dear, what about high school reunions? Are the popular self-redeemable? What do you think? And how do we approach those? They can take us back. Right back.
Yeah, that Tina Fey clip is so perfect because a lot of people go back and find that they had a different level of popularity than they thought that they did. There are some folks who have a particularly hard time seeing how everyone else feels about them, and those are particularly the aggressive kids, just like we saw with that Tina Fey clip. But the other thing that people often see when they go to their high school reunions is those kids who had the highest status who are still really, really focused on status, and that is the kind of ubiquitous reaction that so many people will have after their reunion of saying, oh, those kids that were so cool, they're still kind of doing the same things, still caring about the same things. They've not really changed. And research has suggested that that actually does happen more often than not.
Where does bullying fit into the picture, Mitch? I mean, I'm guessing they desire a form of status.
Well, the bullies are often your controversial kids or your high status kids who are using aggressive to get ahead. And the victims, it's just the hardest thing as a parent to think that your child might be going to school and getting victimized. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I review a little bit is how much parents can play a role and help those victims to do better. There's a lot of research that shows us that the way that we think about victimization can play a very big role on whether it affects us physically or psychologically, and parents can play a really great role in helping kids with that.
All right, let's get to the phones. Betty in Maple Glen, I think. Do we have Betty?
Hi.
We do not? Oh, okay. We don't have that call right now.
Yes, you do. Yes.
Okay, hello. Betty. Hello. Welcome to Radio Times. We only have a moment or so. So quick question from you.
I'll speak fast. Thank you so much. What is the impetus for people to post every darn thing they do. And I have a friend who was in tears yesterday because she saw some friends of hers having birthday dinners with their friends, and she was devastated because she never married. Yeah. What's the impetus to make everybody aware of what you're doing instead of just enjoying the experience?
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Betty.
You're welcome.
And Mitch, any thoughts on that?
It's a great question. You know, social media has made it really easy for us to post things, in some cases, just to get everyone else to notice and to click the like button to show us that they see us, they approve of us. It makes us feel good to have that kind of status. It does not have good long-term effects on us, but there's been research to show that when you post something and see a lot of likes on it, it activates a part of our brains that give us a pleasure response. And that's probably a big part of why we all like to post things that we think will get lots of likes. Mm.
Well, how would you then define likability? How's that shaped on online? What would we see? How would we recognize that as opposed to status?
We might not see it on each other's profiles. It might be what's happening in private messages. It might be what happens because of something you saw online, and that leads you to engage in some offline behavior. It's the one-on-one connections. And the way of truly celebrating others' achievements and connecting with them and learning more about them. Those are things that all promote likability. But we also know those people that post things just to try and get lots of retweets or followers, and that's not about likability at all.
So, Mitch, we're a culture that prizes individualism, and you ask in your book, does individualism give rise to a craving for high status?
Yeah, in my research that we've done in China shows that this is not as big an issue there in a more collectivistic society. The difference between status and likability is not as dramatic. And in fact, while here, the more aggressive you are, the higher status you get over time. In China, the more aggressive you are, the less popular you are over time. So there may be a part of the puzzle here might be the very me culture of Western society.
We got about 30 seconds left, but let's just dig into celebrity a tad. You know, it can seem like an amazing thing to have, but in fact, this enormous popularity can be extremely difficult to deal with. Something to keep in mind, I guess, if you're a teen who's, you know, looking at the stars. Could you get into that for us in about 15 seconds?
Well, I'd say check out the celebrity interviews in the book, and you'll see that those people who have the highest status feel remarkably disconnected, lonely, and the one thing they want more than anything else is they want to be truly liked.
Yeah. All right, Mitch Prinstein, interesting hour. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Mitch Prinstein is author of Popular: The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World, and he is also professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And as always, why not take a moment to visit our Facebook page and also listen to our podcasts? Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times, and we end today with the song Popular from Not a Surf.